Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. Before we start, I'll good soldier this and say that Tennis Channel, self-included, will be at Laver Cup in Chicago this week. But our guest this week is a doubles player and now a former doubles player. It is doubles titan Daniel Nestor, who retired after Canada's Davis Cup tie last weekend. 46 years old, 91 titles. He's won all four of the majors, as I see it, a shoe-in for the Hall of Fame. He called it a career. We talk a bit about his decision, what led up to it, his career, and some really interesting insights, I thought, about the two Canadian stars, Denis Shapovalov and Felix Aliassime. Good conversation with a good guy who is not on the Pro Tour anymore, but will be a part of tennis nonetheless. Here he is, Daniel Nestor. How are you? It's been a busy week.
Not bad. You?
I'm all right. We saw an emotional moment on the court in Toronto a few days ago. Are you still in Canada?
Yeah, I'm in Toronto. Yeah, this is where I live, so just stuck around after the match.
We're done with the Bahamas, so I figure you're 2 days into your retirement. You're on a pool deck right now with bottles of Labatt's empty and stacked up. Is that accurate?
That would be ideal, but I do have a pool at my house. I haven't jumped in it yet. I was cleaning it yesterday. I was cleaning around it and cleaning my my driveway and all the leaves that are starting to fall. So I haven't got around to tanning, but just doing the stuff that I hadn't been doing during the Davis Cup week, so catching up on that stuff.
You're raking leaves. You're like a man in retirement. This is a funny question for a 46-year-old, but why now? What impacted your decision, and why did you make this decision?
Well, I kind of felt at the end of last year that things had changed. Obviously, the results weren't what they used to be, and trying to get the partners that I thought that I could win with was also becoming more difficult. And I just noticed from my own personal performance that I didn't feel like my body was cooperating like it had been. Although I wasn't necessarily in pain or injured or anything, it was just that I just noticed it didn't feel as explosive and just didn't feel like I was getting enough behind the ball anymore and able to stay, with these guys, these younger guys, in situations that I had been able to adapt to in the past, and I was struggling more and more to keep up. And so this year I just wanted to confirm that was actually the case. And I mean, I didn't change anything. I didn't stop training or slow down. I was still being professional, and it just wasn't enough anymore. And although I played well at certain times, it's just not enough at this level anymore.
It's interesting because I always thought of you as sort of a doubles Federer, in the sense that you had seemed to figure out a way to make this work from a family standpoint. We would see your family on the road. I don't know if we ran into each other at Wimbledon. It always seemed like you had figured out the family part of this. So it's interesting to hear you say this was more about the body slowing down and ability. But how have these last few years been like on the domestic front? How did you do this as a husband and a father?
Well, I mean, that's most of the credit goes to my wife, because she was the one that was on her own and with the kids for the most part. I would obviously help and be a proper father when I was with them, but I was away for most of the time, so it was stressful for her. But she's pretty strong-willed, and she got the job done. And a lot of the people that she hangs around have help and nannies and all that, but she kind of did it on her own, and so that was inspiring for me. And she also understood that this is my job, and this is what I'm good at. And so we kind of had a routine, and we were able to travel certain weeks as a family, and other weeks for the most part I was on my own, but I was doing well. And when you're doing something successfully, then there's incentive to keep doing it. But as soon as that changes, and all of a sudden you're not as competitive anymore, and financially it doesn't make sense, then obviously everyone's mindset's going to change, right?
I'm guessing when you started out on this journey, you did not think that, you know, in your mid-40s, you'd still be out here. And we talk a lot in tennis about longevity and, you know, Federer and Serena at 37 and 30 is the new 20. From your standpoint, what do you think it is? I mean, everyone has a theory, whether it's training or money. And from your standpoint, why are we seeing careers last as long as they are?
That's a great question. I don't understand it myself. I mean, the age of the top 100 players, the average age has been going up. Doubles players seem to be playing longer. And I don't know if it's people just, you know, realize the opportunity and maybe have learned from perhaps other players that have retired a bit earlier than they would have liked. Or you see some players retire and then they come back a couple years later, you know, realizing maybe they might have missed out. I don't know if players are, you know, understanding that, or they just, you know, understanding that God put them on the planet to do certain things, and this is what they're good at, and you know, that they're just able to realize that and achieve their goals. And for me, I kind of realized that you know, I want to max it out. Didn't do things always properly when I was young. I didn't really aspire to be a professional tennis player when I was a teenager. I was just good at it, and that's why I played. And it wasn't until, you know, certain things started happening and maybe threatened that. My mom wasn't thrilled with you know, going pro without the results backing it up. So she suggested I go to university. And then as soon as those things started to kind of enter into the equation, then all of a sudden I became way more professional and realized that this is what I want to do. And so that was late teens and my first years on pro. And then from there, I mean, you know, I always felt like in singles I could have done better. You know, not saying I would have been as successful as Milos or Benes, but just knowing that I could have done better, having beaten several top players, kind of ate away at me. And so I think that's why I really, you know, tried to make the most of doubles and really maximize that opportunity. And that's probably why I played as long as I did.
Wait, I want to ask you about that transition, because I was looking up your singles record and you were top 60, but you were very modest. You beat Guga, Rios, Muster, Edberg, Rafter. That's five top number one players you've beaten. You took a set off of Federer at one point. How did you get to that point where you decided, you know what, I'm going to make this transition to doubles? I mean, this was a really nice singles. I think you were top 60 at one point, but those are some, you know, you beat five number one players. When did you make this decision to transition to doubles?
I did it at the end of the 2001 season. I mean, I was fairly successful at singles, but, you know, when I compare myself to guys like Milos and Dennis, I just think they're physically more gifted than I am. I feel like, obviously, my hand-eye coordination is the same level, if maybe even better, but I think the game is very physical, and singles is very physical, and for that reason, you know, I just, when I did play, I just felt like, you know, certain days I felt great, certain days I didn't feel great, and to be a top player, you know, you need to be a combination of a top physical athlete and a top hand-eye coordination athlete, and you know, I just felt like I was half of that, and so it was a challenge. And then in the end of the 99 season, when it was my best year in singles, I was obviously playing a lot of matches because I was still doing well in doubles, and at the end of that season I had surgery. And then the Olympic year in 2000, I kind of struggled to come back in singles, although I had some decent results. You know, I was still committed after we won the gold medal to do well in singles. And the next year, you know, played pretty well, but wasn't the same anymore. And I just felt like the body was, you know, my all of a sudden my shoulder surgery recovery, you know, turned into an elbow problem and just little nagging things. You know, I told the story when I had my retirement party of, you know, the 2001 Rogers Cup. I went to Expo Stadium and I took like 50 of the hardest swings I've ever taken at batting practice and managed to get one over the wall, which I was proud of. But a few days later, I pulled my oblique playing a singles match in Indianapolis. And then all of a sudden my whole summer was ruined from that. And then I came back in the fall, that fall, and you know, I just got frustrated. I wasn't playing as well, and you know, I was already close to 30, and I mean, my whole career was always better at doubles, and you know, I just decided to make that change, and you know, like, really focus on doubles, and yeah, I hadn't won any Grand Slams, and I won the gold medal, but you know, I felt like Mark Knowles and I were in a very similar situation in the 90s, trying to be the best singles players we could be, but we were just better at doubles, and so after that, I called him up and said, let's try and be the best doubles players we can be, and you know, get back together, and we did that, and then we ended up winning slams for the first time, and definitely became a much better doubles player once I just focused on doubles from 2002 on.
I bet if someone said you got 16 more years out here, don't worry about those baseball injuries, you're going to be playing till 2018, you would have signed up for it. Was Mark your favorite partner?
I mean, I've had so many good partners. I mean, Mark and I really got along well. Obviously, the end of the partnership didn't go smoothly. You know, it kind of stopped things mid-season, which was definitely a mistake from my part. You know, not the right thing to do after so many years together. Should have waited till the end of the year. And so that kind of put a strain on things, and then you know, we ended up winning the French Open, trying to prove each other how good we were, and so it ended up kind of positive. But and the Masters that year too for the first time. So you know, we can look back on some great years, but you know, just from that standpoint, it was hard to remember him as my favorite partner. But Zimonjić and I were we had the most success together, and Mirny and I did very well together, and so all three partners were successful, and I look back with fond memories for sure for all three.
How does that work? I mean, I think casual fans are surprised to hear this, that a lot of times doubles partnerships are not based on personalities, and a lot of times there's no love lost between the two people on the same side of the net. How does if just hypothetically, of course, you and, say, Zimonjić weren't great friends, how does that, just joking, but how does that play out? I mean, what are the dynamics of that?
Did you say Zimonjić and I?
I'm just hypothetically. I don't want to name names, Zimonjić. If you,
oh, sorry.
You're retired now. You're retired. You can.
Sorry, you're cutting out again. Yeah, I mean, from my experience, you kind of feel things right away with a partner, and you know, you have that chemistry. And that's something that you can't take for granted. And you see a lot of you know, a lot of guys doing well, and then you know, 6 months later, you know, they kind of you know, not really going as far forward, and all of a sudden they panic, and then you know, they start pointing fingers, and then all of a sudden they're playing with different partners, not realizing that with this former partner that's where they made their breakthrough. And obviously, you know, you got to take all these factors into consideration, but you know, too often doubles players are, you know, looking at other opportunities and not at the, you know, the partnership that makes sense. And I mean, I'm just as guilty as anyone, but it's definitely a learning lesson. And I mean, yeah, like you said, you can't always have the perfect partner. You can't have a perfect partner in so many different facets of life, but you gotta work on things and communicate and understand that you can be successful. You know, not always seeing eye to eye, but respecting each other and working together to try and be the best possible team.
I'm listening to you talk about this, and I'm thinking, boy, if only you had an identical twin, that would make finding a doubles partner a lot easier. Let me ask you, you mentioned Dennis and Felix, and I think they both seem to recognize they're going to be paired together in conversation for much of their careers. How do you assess each of them?
Yeah, I'm so impressed with both these guys. I mean, obviously Dennis, he's got so much potential. We played doubles together in Queens this year. He's had such a big game from, you know, huge serve, big forehand, big backhand. I mean, such nice long strokes on each side with so much power and capability, and he's just kind of I feel like he's dominating his opponents. The only time he gets in trouble is when he he overdoes it and he goes for too much. He's definitely got an attacking personality, which I can relate to. And I love watching him play. I just think sometimes he needs to, you know, maybe take 10% off his ball and try and hit a winner maybe on the third shot as opposed to on the first shot of the rally. But that'll come with experience. And a guy like Felix, I mean, this was the first time I actually hit with him this last week in Davis Cup. And I just could not believe how athletic he was. And, I mean, he has the perfect tennis body, if not perfect athletic body. I compared him to a mix of Djokovic and Spider-Man. I mean, he covers the court and he's lean and he's ripped and he's like six foot five and the guy's like a cat on the court and not to mention he hits the ball great and these two guys, I don't think they realize, I think they do realize, but I just hope they realize how much potential they have and what they can do for Canadian tennis and tennis in the international stage, because we could be seeing these guys. Like Dennis told Neelix at the end of that tough match at the U.S. Open, we're going to be here playing a final one day, and I honestly think that's true.
What do you tell them? And you, I will credit you for starting this Canadian tennis boom. But what do you tell those guys? I mean, I'm sure, you know, you're 25 years older than they are, but I could tell from Davis Cup how they looked up to you. What were some of the things you were trying to impart to them?
Honestly, it's not that much. I mean, these guys are that's the thing, and another thing that we talked about earlier, my singles compared to their singles. I mean, these guys, I just feel like from a young age, these guys were really focused and they knew what they wanted, and that's why they're so ahead of the game. And I'm almost in awe of them, and from that aspect. And you know, I talked to Felix for the first time, I talked to Dennis. These kids are intelligent kids. You know, you talk about this iPad generation. They're not having the focus that they once did, but I don't see it with them. And you can throw Milos and Vasek in there too. I mean, they're still in their 20s. And these guys are all so focused and they're doing all the right things and they all want to be the best they can be. And so it's really not that much work, or mentoring with these guys. It's more just, you know, keeping them positive and just making sure they're, you know, thinking the right things and not getting down on themselves, you know, with a couple bad results and that kind of stuff. Because I think the way they're handling things and the way they're doing things, they're all heading in the right direction and they're all going to be around for a long time.
You've always been good at analyzing top players in singles as well. How surprised are you that Djokovic, who, you know, nearly wasn't seeded for the French Open, has won two straight majors now with a Masters 1000 sandwiched in between? How much are you surprised by this return of Djokovic?
Again, for me, it's not a physical thing. It's just a mental thing. So seeing him, you know, in the locker room getting really spiritual, you know, 18 months ago, 2 years ago, and just wondering where he was at mentally and now seeing him, you know, in a better place. And I mean, his game, I mean, he's totally back, obviously, by his results. I mean, you watched him play. The guy's not making one on fourth there. No one in the history of tennis has moved the way he has and put himself in a position with every single shot to play that level. And I mean, I've never seen someone with that balance and athleticism, you know, coming ball side to side. So I think the physical aspect was there. It's just the mental aspect has improved to where it used to be. He's back, he's motivated, and I'm sure these three guys. Federer's already got that lead of Grand Slam titles, but I'm sure Nadal and Djokovic are still thinking they're in that hunt. So it's going to be interesting to see how long these guys continue doing this and dominating the sport and. I guess it's great for tennis that they're still sticking around, and then you have this new crop of exciting stars knocking on the door. So I think tennis has never been so popular, and there's a lot to look forward to in the sport, not just from Canada, but from an international standpoint.
Have you ever heard of the campsite rule of dating? Is that familiar to you?
No.
It's you want to leave your partner, regardless of what happens, you want to leave your partner in a better place than when you found him or her. I'm wondering, apply that to tennis. Do you feel like you left the sport in a better place than you found it? I mean, do you feel the sport is healthier now than when you started your career in the early 90s, or are you concerned?
I think it's come full circle, to be honest. When I came in, I felt like the sport was very popular. You know, it was the tail end of McEnroe and Lendl, and I guess Connors was still around. And then you had this new crop of exciting stars like Sampras, Courier, Agassi, that were taking over, and Michael Chang, and even Istovich, and so many different kinds of personalities, and engaging with the fans, and fans could relate to them. And I think, then it kind of slowed down a little bit in the 90s. You know, it was a kind of a two-man show. Maybe Becker wasn't playing as well as he should have, and so it was kind of a two-man show with Sampras and Agassi. And you know, the game had gotten a little bit fast. I think the courts were really fast, and the rallies weren't what they should have been. And you know, so I think it kind of slowed down a little bit there. And I was kind of part of that. And I think in the last 5-10 years, now that Federer's had some competition with Djokovic and Nadal, and you know, the games got so athletic and they slowed it down, and I think it might have gone a little bit too far in that direction, because some of these rallies are bordering on too long and too repetitive and too similar. But I think the game is at an all-time high with these top players and you know, the guys that are the next generation, and plus I think just from the sport in general, people's desire to live a healthy lifestyle and fitness being a important part of that. I think more and more people are playing tennis for that reason, and it's a sport that you can play your whole life. It's a great sport to stay in shape, and I think it's a combination of all those things. And we're seeing in Canada the sport is booming, and I think around the world from these tournaments that I've played, I've just noticed a resurgence of fans and interest, and even in doubles, people are watching more and more doubles, and obviously singles is where it's at. But it's come full circle. I think I came in at a great time, and there was a little bit of lull along the way, but it's definitely picked up in the last 5 years, I would say, and now it's peaking again.
All right, speed round. Answer these in one word or one sentence. Short questions. Would you have voted for this new Davis Cup format?
Well, I heard Davis Cup format. What was the question?
Would you have voted for it if you had a vote? Would you have voted for it? No. Can you believe Maple Leaf Gardens is now a grocery store?
Can I believe that?
I just drove by it. I was in Toronto the other day. I said, oh, that's where Maple Leaf Gardens, and I looked on the side,
yeah,
and it's some been, like
yeah, they had a
food.
Seniors event. We've done some charity events there. It's sad. I mean, there's a group, I'm not a Leafs fan, but there's a lot of history in that building. But, no, I can't believe that.
All right, I won't ask you about John Gomeshi. Your credentials would make you a very attractive candidate to the Tennis Hall of Fame. How much does that matter to you?
Well, obviously, it would be an immense honor for me to be even considered with some of the top players that get voted into that. So, I mean, obviously, my credentials, might be worthy of it. But, I also grew up or played through, a lot of talk about covering half the court and it is doubles and that. So I don't know. I don't know what to say. I mean, I know my level. I feel like I'm a very good tennis player. But the people that enter the Hall of Fame are amazing tennis players. So I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I'll leave that up to the people who vote.
Well, Tom Tebbit will head your he'll be your Paul Manafort. He'll head up your candidacy. So you've raked the you've raked the leaves. You've only been retired for 2 days, but what's the future hold? What's next for you?
Yeah, I really want to stay involved in tennis, and especially in Canada. I want to help promote the sport and kind of travel around the country and do that. And, you know, at all levels, I mean, whether it's kids or high performance or adults, I mean, I think there's something special going on in this country with tennis, and, you know, let's stay involved in that and help it grow.
You are shaming the United States. You're too modest to say this, but I'll say it for you. If there's the tennis boom in Canada, you are one of the founders. So I hope you take some real satisfaction in that. These kids came of age when you were winning Grand Slam titles and Olympic medals, and here we are in 2018, and you have one-tenth of our population, and you have a very bright tennis future. Congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Daniel. Take care, and we'll miss you out there, but hope paths cross again soon. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks to Daniel Nestor. Tennis is down a good guy with his retirement this past weekend, but 25, 26 your careers don't come around all that often. Again, Newport bound as I see it. We can save that discussion for another time. But with that, let's bring in Jamie Lasanti. We missed you out at the tennis. We were two subway cars passing in the night. I was doing morning shifts. You were there later. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Do we agree the Serena Noble or whatever we're calling it, Serena Gate, women's final gate, enough ink has been spilled, enough pixels have been spent. Let's move on, or is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I think we're gonna move on.
I agree wholeheartedly.
I think we have
the dead horse and metaphor comes quickly to mind. Let's move forward. First of all, what struck you about that conversation?
I really liked his opinion and thoughts on the younger players. I think he's 46 years old. I mean, we talk about Federer being old.
What's wrong with 46 years
he's
old?
He's 10 years older
Dude.
Than Federer. I'm
oh,
not
okay.
saying there's anything
okay.
wrong with that. Okay. I'm saying in perspective of we right. talk about age in tennis, he is that much older. So it was really cool to hear him talk about Felix and Dennis, and just even about their body types and how he sort of looks at them and really sees players who are unlike peers of their age and you know, hopefully going to be champions in the sport. So I thought that was really cool.
I thought that was really interesting too about, did you catch what he was saying about sort of the iPad generation
yeah,
and
yeah,
the
yeah.
ADD? Because that's something you hear about with Kyrgios. It's something, honestly, you hear about even with Sasha Zverev. How's this guy going to win a best of five match when he's checking his phone at every changeover? Or, I mean,
right.
maybe not changeover, but, you know, I think that was a complaint that one of his former coaches had.
I think I was talking to a friend who coaches high school football, and he was telling me about how a lot of them have attitudes, and that's not unnormal in high school sports, but they grew up in this generation of not just having stuff on TV, but Instagram, and that's something that I'd even grow up with, you know, playing sports, and they see things and they think they have to act a certain way or be a certain way to kind of have that, or they go on Snapchat and they have to be this way, and they kind of have this attitude, and they don't really want to, you know, just work hard and put that stuff down and put that stuff away, and they kind of want to broadcast everything. So it's interesting to hear about him say that these two kids are
Not
part of
sustained
that,
focus.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
I thought, I think there's a whole book to be written about this Instagram persona that all kids have, and everything's great and it's completely artificial. But I think, you know, U.S. Open, let's go back there. We're not going to talk about Serena, but we'll talk about another tired topic, which is Nick Kyrgios. I was really struck. I don't know if you followed this. The Mo Leani, the controversial match and
yes.
With Herbert, and Donna Vekic weighs in
right.
with a tweet. And Nick Kyrgios then gets in this Twitter battle with Donna Vekic. And what struck me was the time code on those tweets. Clearly, Nick Kyrgios, and I don't think he's alone in this, clearly he goes back into the locker room and the first thing he does is check his phone. So this is minutes after walking off court, winning a Grand Slam singles match, and he's on his phone having these Twitter battles. And to me, that was a real revelation about just the media consumption of young athletes today. Where before they've taken a shower, before they've dissected the match with a coach, before they're, you know, again, this is a favorite topic of mine, but before all of these chemicals coursing through their body, all the cortisol levels normalize, first thing he does clearly is check his phone. Boy, that's a generational demarcation right there. That's it's an interesting way to comport yourself. But anyway, it was interesting to hear that. And you get the feeling that the Dennis and Felix both have this level of maturity that informs their success. I don't know if you saw this when Felix had the, I'm blanking on the term, but the racing heart that caused him to withdraw from that first round match. And Dennis goes to the other side of the net and is very poised and sort of says, listen, we're going to be doing this again. We're going to be playing in finals one day. First he said, try your best. You're telling your opponent, basically giving them a pep talk. And then, I thought that showed, I mean, you can prepare an athlete for a lot of circumstances and a lot of, exigency of eventuality. I mean, that was not a situation that athletes prepare for, to see your friend and opponent on the ground trying to get his heart rate to slow down.
We like pep talks, just not from the
Not from the chair umpire, and we don't often get them
from
the opponent.
We don't have to get back into that.
As well. So tennis is at this strange position right now where we head into the fall season, but we've played all four of the majors. Bit of anticlimax, perhaps. We do have both tours have their... We have a Davis Cup final. We have both tours have their season enders. But for all intents, if the four majors are the four tent poles, we've already passed those. So it's a bit of a strange time. Unclear if we'll see Serena again before Melbourne. But give us three storylines that you, Jamie Lasanti, will be following this indoor season, this autumn in tennis. Put you on the spot.
One thing really recently I thought was, just came up, Maria Sharapova shutting down her season for 2018. I thought it was kind of interesting. I know it's not a storyline that obviously she won't be playing, but thought it was interesting. She really has had a rough go since coming back, and I made the point her Nike contract is up in 2018.
Right. Well, she makes a lot of money playing it. That she does not take missing that Asia trip lightly.
Right. And so there's just a lot of things about that I think are interesting. And I don't know. Do you think we'll see any sort of announcement from her this fall about anything?
I think it's really interesting because it's the same central personality trait, but it just is going to be a question of which way does it express herself. Does her, I think ego is a loaded term, but does her abundance of pride, does that mean, listen, I can't abide by these results. It's been a nice career.
Right. You've mentioned that before.
Or does that very same trait mean she's saying, God damn it, I'm not going out like this. I'm going to train like hell and I think I can still win majors. I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting to see which way that breaks, because the one thing I think we can agree, this status quo is not working for her.
Yeah.
And ever since she's come back, and I think I've talked about this before, I think there's a whole psychology when you return from a doping suspension. I think you're playing largely to reestablish yourself, but you're also playing to validate what you did before this, to show the world, hey, listen, I didn't achieve what I achieved because of these banned substances. And this post-comeback, whatever you want to call it, this post-suspension comeback has not gone well for Maria Sharapova. She's now north of age 30. Something's got to give here. Either the ranking's got to go up and she's got to remember who she used to be, or simply win more matches, or else she's got to call it a career. But it's not. The status quo is not going to work either way. That struck me as well, especially because that is multi-millions of dollars that she has passed up by not going to Asia.
Right. So it should be interesting.
All right, what's number two?
Novak Djokovic, we'll switch over to ATP before I give you my third one. Novak Djokovic wins the U.S. Open without some fanfare because of everything that went on. But... It's pretty
crazy
impressive.
Story.
If you really go totally back to January of this year, the way we were talking about Novak and kind of where he could be at this point in the season was definitely not here. So I just think it is a insane turnaround for him this summer. And so, of course, I want to see what happens for the rest of the year. Can he keep it up? Does he try and settle down a bit because he has played a lot of matches now? And maybe, the one thing that you think about with he did have an injury, which played a role in everything. But, is he playing too much too quickly, doing not too well, but he's really surging. So is he going to maybe aggravate something? Should he take some time? I don't know.
There's a Lacoste store in the village not far from me, and it's all congratulations to Novak Djokovic turning 18. 6 months ago, we were saying, boy, Lacoste really made a bad bet on that one, and how long is he going to stay with Agassi? I mean, never mind January, like you said. I mean, he lost to Taro Daniel on hard courts in Indian Wells, and there was this look of like, boy, is this a lost soul. He did not have great success on the clay before the French Open, and he very nearly wasn't seeded in Paris. He left, remember, he lost to, who did he lose? To Cecchinato amid a weekend, and boy, this guy who used to make Grand Slam semis as a matter of, you know, ritual, who, you know, right, had won double-digit majors, and now he's struggling to reach week two. If you'd said he's going to close out the year by winning the last two majors, you'd say that's an extraordinary turnaround. So I think you're right. I think that's a good one. And I think you're right, too, that we talk about Naomi Osaka and she didn't get her due and how awkward it was, and she wins a tournament, but she's the one crying on the podium. But I'm not sure this Djokovic story quite got the publicity it deserved either. I mean, it's hard enough to back up a major, but for Novak Djokovic, Agassi leaves the camp, and everybody's sort of wondering how much of this is the elbow, how much of this is spiritual, I think was the euphemism we all seized on, how much of this was personal. It is remarkable. I mean, he wins Wimbledon, he wins a Masters 1000 in Cincinnati, beating Federer in the final, and then he backs it up by winning the U.S. Open. It's been an extraordinary 90 days. That's a hell of a return for Djokovic, and I'm not sure that got the due. But I'm glad it did from you, Jamie Lasanti. All right, what's your third? We're running low on time here. What's your third point?
Madison Keys. I
didn't expect you to pull that one out. All right, what do you got?
Only because she kind of has had a tough go. I mean, last year at the U.S. Open, obviously, and then this year again. Naomi Osaka was just unbeatable, you know, and she proved that. It was her tournament. She was the champion of this tournament. But Madison has come so close so many times, and she really, she has the game of a player who can win majors and win titles, and she just, there's just something blocking her there. And I feel for her in so many ways. And I'm just really hoping that she can kind of continue to build on everything and not take a one step forward, one step back approach, which it almost seems like she's doing sometimes. So I'm interested to kind of see how she recovers in the fall season and then going ahead into Australia in January.
Good one. I feel like it's a little like Zverev on the men's side, where this shortcomings in majors are like compounding interest. Like it puts all the more pressure on the next one. And now, of course, you know, we're still, it's mid-September and we don't go to Australia until mid-January. So it's a little bit of time here. One thing I like about Madison Keys is she's been through a lot of coaches. And clearly she has a very special relationship with Lindsay, who among us doesn't? But you know, that's for a variety of reasons, not least Lindsay has four kids. That's perhaps not sustainable. And she's had a really hard time finding other coaches. I don't think I'm violating any secrets when I say that. And I think, to me, that shows an assertiveness. That shows sort of a lack of contentment. I think there's that sort of actually revealing that she's had a number of coaching relationships where she says, this ain't working for me. I mean, she deals with Ola Momkus at the USTA, and he and Lindsay seem to sort of tag team it a bit at the U.S. Open. But I think it says something about Madison's personality that she has these expectations and she has this assertiveness where she's willing to make these changes. But yeah, I mean, there's no question. The game is there. The power's there. Osaka was a strange match. Remember, she had all those break points. I think it was 13 break points. And yeah, you can chalk that out. Hey, I just ran into a hot player. But, you know, Madison Keys beat Osaka at that very same tournament at that same court 2 years ago. So did this person eat my lunch? I mean, who 2 years ago would have thought Naomi Osaka would have beaten Madison Keys to the punch? But I still think it's a question of when and not if for her. I still, if you said, will Madison Keys win a major, yes or no, I still am voting yes.
I think she's comparable to Halep in many ways in that sense, because for a while we were saying the same thing, when if not if, about her. I worry then that when that time comes, you know, Halep is, what's the stat? She made two finals this year and like, the rest were first or second round exits.
Yeah, it's been an interesting Grand Slam season for
Halep. And so I worry that that happens again with her.
With Madison.
But
yeah, but then you have the Wozniacki will say, listen, whatever I do the rest of my career, I'm a Grand Slam winner. And even a player as accomplished as she is, who's been number one, once she won that Grand Slam, you get the feeling there's sort of a level of satisfaction that no matter what happens from here on out, the one thing I'll always be able to say is I'm a major winner. But No, I didn't think you'd go with Madison Keys as your third card, but don't apologize. Mm-hmm. Inspired pick. All right. You need to go. I need to go. That will do it for us. Again, thanks, Daniel Nestor. Good conversation with a longtime doubles player and I would argue a future Hall of Famer. Jamie, thanks as always.
Thanks, John.
Nice to have you back. We'll do it again next week. Thanks for listening, everyone. Keep the suggestions coming, and we'll talk in 7 days.